You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 14th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
And Evan Bernstein.
I just realized July 14th, 2021 is 7/14/21. There you go. 7 plus 7 plus 7.
What are the odds?
I like it.
Of that mathematical alignment.
Trillion to one.
Jay's traveling back from Hawaii today. He managed to arrange his two-week vacation so that he exactly missed three Wednesdays.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
He'll have some splaining to do next week.
Yeah, I don't know how that will. Some Jay-splaining?
Yeah.
So what are you guys up to? What did you do today? Did you accomplish anything?
I took class all day.
Just work.
I worked, yep, and prepared for this show.
I planted a tree.
Ah.
Oh,
that's
I see.
That's a lot of work. Planting a tree is not easy.
Depends on the tree.
Well, it wasn't a sapling. This was a like 15-foot, 20-year-old.
A redwood?
Tree, no. It's a birch. Birch tree.
You had it delivered?
Yes, I had it delivered.
Okay, so they did that part.
Yeah, it was too big to fit in a car. It was a huge...
And like a big root ball, right?
Yep.
So how'd you move it from where you needed it? Or did they drop it off right where you needed it?
Yeah, so I was there when they arrived. And I'm like, can you put it right here? And they
yes.
did.
Good. So you just had to dig the hole, right? And then gently place it into the hole.
Wait, can you imagine transplanting a redwood? That's like maybe like impossible.
Well, it depends on how old it is.
How big are their roots?
I'm talking about, you know, a big-ass redwood. That's, yeah, it'd be impossible.
200-footers?
Yeah, probably.
That would be
what
impossible.
What could possibly, yeah,
like
nothing
a mature
could possibly.
One? Yeah, yeah.
That's the implication. Mature, big, heavy.
No.
Yeah, wow.
That would be an engineering project.
I don't know.
Lodestar could do it.
But a 15-foot birch sounds doable.
So what happened was I had a previous birch tree there that slowly died over the last 4 or 5 years. And I was trying to figure out why it was dying. Turns out it was a victim of a, you know, a tree boring parasite.
Yeah,
you could see the tiny little holes in it. That is specific to birch trees.
Also, how are you going to protect this one?
So that's a great question.
Force field.
So when we bought it, you know, I explained what was happening to the tree expert at the nursery where we bought it, and he said, yeah, that's this very specific thing. And Connecticut doesn't allow you to apply the insecticide that would kill it.
Mm.
So, okay.
Okay.
So of course they can't keep those birch trees anymore because basically they're all wiped out by this parasite.
Right.
So he has a different kind of birch tree because there's lots of different kinds that is apparently resistant to it. Oh. So we'll put that to the test. Hopefully it'll
I wonder
be resistant.
If they... Did they genetically modify it to be resistant, or did it just grow? It's a variety that grew
just happens
its own
to
resistance.
Be.
So it's a different species of birch that is resistant to this particular parasite.
Okay,
right. And the reason why I had to get one so big, I didn't have to, but I want to, is that this was my second child's birth tree. So I had to get one that was as old as she was. Because I have trees that I planted when the girls, each group of my daughters were born.
That's cool.
I thought that was some sort of like hippie astrology thing.
No, I just wanted to, you know, just
no, it's feng shui. Come on.
You know, it's like, this is your tree. It's as old as you are. And just get them invested in taking care of it, et cetera. And
water it every day.
Do
you make sure to get trees that grow similarly so that one child isn't like, meh, when they see their birth tree?
No, they're totally different. I mean, okay. My older daughter has a maple tree. This my younger. I let her choose what tree she wants. Who's, you know, when she was a younger child, and so anyway, I had to get one that was as old as she was to replace the one that died.
And did you have help putting this tree into the ground?
My daughter, whose tree it is, helped me.
Okay, good.
Yeah, we planted it together.
Nice.
I dug the hole though. I did like all the heavy lifting, and then she helped me put it in the ground, put the rocks around it, and the mulch and all that stuff.
Awesome.
It's pretty though. I really, really like it. But damn, that was like and it was hot today.
Yeah, it was. It was a hot one today.
But I had to get it in the ground. You know, that tree would not have survived very long in this weather, you know, with a naked bulb.
Yep, I've planted trees.
You just soaked it? I guess it's the water.
The thing is, though, it was in the ground for a long time. It still had a bulb, but it was in the ground. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And like we had to negotiate with the nursery when they would be willing to deliver it to us because they said, nope, it's too hot today. It's going to be too traumatic for the tree, blah, blah, blah.
It's nice that they care.
Yeah, so then they were very specific about the fact that we really needed to minimize the shock to this tree and get it in the ground right away, give it a good watering and everything. So I had to do it. All right, well, we're going to start this show with a COVID update. We haven't done one of those in a while because I've been getting a lot of questions about from patients and just acquaintances and stuff.
And me.
When do we need to get a COVID vaccine booster?
Yeah. I mean, my third shot, when?
Yeah.
My hospital's still saying no booster.
So, yeah, so let's go over all the data, right? Yeah. So there are two big reasons why you would want to get a booster. And what a booster means is you've already had a full vaccine schedule with full immunity. And then sometime down the road, you get another vaccine. So if you got one of the mRNAs, where that's a two dose, a booster would just be a third dose. So you wouldn't have to do the full routine again. So there are two reasons why you would need to do that. One is that your immunity is decreasing over time, and then you would need to literally boost your immunity back up to the full, you know, vaccinated level. And the other is that new variants are circulating that are not as well covered by the vaccine. So obviously, the World Health Organization, what we've been calling the WHO, but some people apparently don't like that. But I mean, right? If you're your acronym?
Acronym.
Your acronym is WHO. What's wrong with calling them the WHO? Anyway, the WHO and the CDC have been tracking these variables very closely. So let's talk about where we are with this. So what is the evidence for the duration of immunity from the prevailing vaccines? I can't obviously can't talk about every single vaccine out there. I'm going to focus on the mRNA vaccines for now. But I think the data with other vaccines is similar, but I'm just going to focus on the two mRNA ones. So that's the Pfizer and the Moderna ones. So there's a study published in Nature just in June. This is the latest data. So this is in June 2021. And they showed that there were high levels of two different markers of immunity. So now they're not testing whether or not people are resistant to the disease, just do they have, you know, antibodies and B cells against SARS-CoV-2 in their blood, right? So that's, again, there's two ways you could tell if you have immunity. One is to measure for a marker of immunity, and the other one is to see what's your chance of getting sick, right? They could look at a bunch of people and say, are people who are vaccinated still not getting sick from COVID as frequently as people who are not vaccinated? All right, so this study was looking at markers, two different biomarkers of immunity in people up to 12 weeks after their mRNA vaccine. This was either Pfizer or Moderna. And they found that the levels were remaining very high. So that's great. So that's 3 months. You know, you have pretty much full immunity. But they also estimated the half-life because they could track these out, not just 2 points in time. They were actually marking them out over time. Mm-hmm. And depending on which method they used, and the different ways of estimating the half-life, they come up with a range of about between 69 and 173 days. Again, that's not of immunity, that's of the half-life.
Half-life, yeah.
It's a hell of a range.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty big. So, but they're looking at everything and said, yeah, it would probably be good for anywhere between 6 and 12 months. Maybe longer, if at the low end of the range.
But I got vaccinated in January.
Yeah, so if you were the earliest, not the people in the study, but the earliest cohort of people just getting the vaccine are just coming up on that 6 month mark now. So they're pretty confident that 6 months is good in terms of immunity, but it's probably up to 12, maybe longer, based on that study. In April, Pfizer released their data for their vaccine, and this is now looking at clinical efficacy, protection from getting infected. And they found that at 6 months, that the vaccine efficacy was 91.3%, which is great,
good.
Right?
Yeah, it's amazing.
95 was like the baseline, right? After 2 weeks after your
second dose. Yeah, it wasn't 100 to begin with.
So it's only dropped a tiny little bit.
Wait, is it 91% or 91% of 95?
No, it's 91.3% efficacy after 6 months, with 100% protection from severe disease. As defined by the CDC. Yeah, so you're not going to die if you have the vaccine, even if you get sick.
Those are the reports I'm seeing out of LA County and like California State are saying that something like 99.999, and I'm not exaggerating when I say this, like the actual numbers are 99 with multiple nines.
Yeah, they
after.
Go to the thousandth or the 10,000th.
But there's digit. Very few people, it's very rare. Like, yeah, one in 10.
Yeah, they're saying those 99.999 whatever percent of patients that are being hospitalized for COVID right now are unvaccinated.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Exactly.
Yep. Yeah. And that's just, and that's hospitalized.
Yes. Yeah.
Not even, you know, dying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
then again, so Pfizer was like, so we're good up to 6 months. That's where we are right now. If you look clinically or if you look at markers, it looks like we're good for at least 6 months out from the second dose. And from what I'm reading, I think the consensus of expert opinion is we'll probably be good till 12 months. How long, and again, there's nothing magical about 12 months, but how long the immunity will be good beyond that still remains to be seen. Again, we won't know until we're there. But if I think the smart money is basically saying we're probably going to need an annual booster based upon this data.
But why are we only six? Why do we only have 6 month data? Because you know people.
We don't. They're tracking it all the way through. They're just, you know, that's just chunking it for convenience.
It's also probably just how long science happens. You know, if you're right, there were people who were getting vaccinated, but they were getting vaccinated as part of clinical trials.
When did people get the vaccine that's available now? They got it when? Like August, September, July?
No, only as part of clinical trials.
Right.
I was in the first
January,
cohort.
January, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, there were
a few people in November, December, then really started hitting
January. I'm talking about the people that it was tested on. There was thousands of people.
The clinical trials.
Last fall.
Yeah, when was that? Only that was,
like last June, July, like a year.
So there are people out there that have had it for a year. So can't we? Why don't we have anything approaching like 9 month or 12 month outlooks? Because people have the vaccine in their bodies for 9 to 12 months.
I know they're tracking those people as well, but I think they also want to look at people out in the wild. You know, like people actually were getting it outside the clinical trial, just because they're more general population.
What difference does it make? It doesn't matter who was injected in. It's what you get injected, and I'm assuming that they got the same exact thing that's out in the wild now. Isn't that what really matters? Not who they are.
No, who you are does matter. Because if you're doing it in young, healthy people, you won't necessarily expect the exact same effect in somebody who's older or who's sick or whatever.
Well, of course, but I think they would do a broad range of people, probably mostly older people. I would think they would do the clinical trials on. I mean, sure, there's plenty of people over 50 and 60.
They always choose the best case scenario for a clinical trial. They want to give them. They're just trying to show efficacy. So, but anyway, let's not get off on that tangent. This is the data we have. This is the data the CDC is citing. WHO is citing. And because this is, first of all, it's far greater numbers than the people in the clinical trials, and it's more of a general population.
I'd also be interested to see, Steve, maybe anecdotally is the wrong word, but yeah, maybe anecdotally, like if from a trends perspective, if we start to see healthcare workers getting sick.
Mm-hmm.
Because healthcare workers were among the first ones vaccinated.
Yeah.
They're also among the highest exposure potentiality. And so, you know, early on, healthcare workers were getting sick in droves. And then
that would be a good canary in a coal mine, I guess.
Exactly. You know. Like more of a kind of a real world. Like if we're starting to see any trends in that way, then we better pick up the pace.
Yeah, but luckily, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it.
Not been a trend. Yeah.
Can someone get a booster right now if they wanted one?
Right now.
No. But we'll get there in a second.
Okay. All right.
But I don't think it would harm you, and it would probably help a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, I think when it comes to medicine, more is not always better. So
no, but I remember hearing about people that did get. Oh wait, am I confusing that with people that mixed the vaccines, Pfizer first,
probably?
Or Darren,
probably
maybe not mixing very good it with guidance that. To be coming out of our mouths. It's not recommended. It's not available to anybody. Don't go get a back alley vaccine right now.
Yeah. I mean, that's something you definitely want data on. All right. Let's shift to is the current vaccine covering the variants? And right now, the most concerning variant is the Delta variant, right? This is the one that's pretty much taken over the UK, is becoming the most dominant variant in the US. And
but now we're talking Lambda too.
There's going to be more variants. Epsilon. But this is sort of Delta's the current one that I think is becoming dominant, and it's also more infectious than the baseline variant. It is quote unquote covered by the current vaccines. But let's look at some data, right? Coming out of the UK, this is looking at the Pfizer mRNA vaccine. What they found was that If you get one dose of the mRNA vaccine, right, you're supposed to get two. If you get one dose, you're 80% covered, right? That's 80% efficacy. And if you get two doses, you have 95% efficacy. Mm-hmm. That's from the normal variant. However, against the Delta variant, if you get one dose, it's only 34% Whoa. Effective, and two doses, 84% effective. So it's still effective, but much less so. And there are a lot of people out there that only got one dose, that didn't get their second dose, and it's only 34% effective against a single dose of the Pfizer vaccine.
Wow.
So that's still good protection. That 84% is still good, but... Yeah. And this is total protection. It's still protecting. It's still keeping people from getting hospitalized.
It's better than most flu seasons.
And the Delta variant isn't the only one that has lower protection from the vaccines. The protection from the Beta variant, which was another one of the variants. I think the Alpha variant was what we were calling the UK variant. Beta was a different one. Is 20% less than the protection from the baseline.
Delta.
Than baseline SARS-CoV-2. So these new variants are still covered by the vaccine, but less so, but increasingly less so, if that makes sense. So the Delta variant is the least well covered of the new variants. Now, if there's newer ones still popping up around the world that we have to keep an eye on, and of course, like once the Delta variant is pretty much dominant everywhere, then we might see variants of it. That you know what I mean? And you get the variants of variants thing where. You know, who knows where this is going to lead. So essentially the virus does mutate and there is this variant creep that happens throughout the pandemic, moving farther and farther away from the vaccines. And so that's another reason why you'd want to get a booster. But here, Bob, is why you wouldn't just get like a third dose of the same vaccine. We want, Pfizer and Moderna to make a booster vaccine that is optimized, tailored to the new variants.
Yeah, I heard they're doing that.
They are doing that. They absolutely are doing that. Right now, there is no recommendation for a booster shot, right? And there was recently the joint CDC-FDA statement said, the evidence so far indicates that a vaccine booster is not necessary. But they're going to continue to monitor, the effectiveness going forward. And at some point, they may decide, okay, now we need to do a booster. Now, the WHO, the director of the WHO, is not happy about all this. This is Tedros. He said, we're making conscious choices right now not to protect those in most need. What he is saying is these rich nations should stop obsessing about their booster shots until we give everybody else their first shot.
Yeah.
And I only sort of agree with him. I think the problem is he's acting as if this is a forced choice. And it isn't necessarily. I mean, we can produce vaccines for the world while also working on a booster vaccine to cover new variants.
Yeah, but we're not. That's really the issue. Is like we can say it is in theory not a forced choice, but the truth of the matter is we're not getting vaccines out fast enough, and we're not getting them into the hands of those who need them, and we are more concerned to some extent.
So
about treating our
if you look at this, that's correct. I mean, although there's a recent push, like the pledges to make billions of vaccines available, and it's still not enough to cover everybody, but we're moving in the right direction. But I'm just saying from a it may not be happening right now, but there is no reason why we can't do this. And I haven't read anything to say that like Moderna is going to be putting out booster shots instead of putting out just vaccines. But here's the other thing. When we do get around to vaccinating everybody, do we want to give them the old vaccine or do we want to give them a new vaccine that's covering the new variants that are actually threatening them?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying.
They're going to be more exposed to that.
Yeah, they're not. These are not mutually exclusive. So, keeping the vaccines up with the variants will help everybody.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And we definitely, need the world economy to keep going, and so I think we have to look at this holistically, you know, like the overall effect, you know, not just, yes, of course we want to get everybody vaccinated because everyone benefits from that. It slows down the pandemic. It reduces the risk of more variants popping up. It's the right thing to do. But at the same time, we also have to protect the world's economy, and we need to keep doing research to come out with to update the vaccine against new variants. Everyone will benefit from that. No, I think just we need to do more overall. But I just think we need to do everything. I don't think we should pick and choose which things that we're going to do at this point.
Yeah, I think the issue here is that the World Health Organization understands that better than almost anyone.
Oh, I know.
When they're working with the CDC, they probably get pretty frustrated by the mentality coming out of the U.S.
And Tedros and the World Health Organization, they are very focused on this sort of level playing field of medical justice throughout the world. That's their thing.
That's going to be something I touch on.
I know. That's just going to say that. Yeah. I know you're touching on that in your news item as well, because that's clearly, that's one of their main concerns. So I get it. I totally get it. And if there's anyone in the world to say, hey, let's not forget that we still have to vaccinate, all of these people, they're the ones who should be saying it. That is kind of their point to make. But, I agree with that as far as it goes, but I think we also need to update the vaccines to cover the new variants.
Yeah.
And which means, when a year rolls around and it's time to get a booster, fine. Give people the booster who need to get a booster, obviously. And as a healthcare worker, and you too, Kara, we're going to be one of the first ones to get it when it becomes available.
We will. Oh, the sad thing about the U.S. is that, like, I'm excited to get a booster if a booster becomes available. I want to continue to protect myself. I want to finally freaking start to live as if we're not living in a global pandemic, because at least in my part of town, which is quite progressive and which has some of the strictest guidance, I'm still wearing a mask in public everywhere I go. Like, this is still part of my everyday. I mean, granted, luckily I can go into a store now, but most people still aren't dining indoor. It's kind of a difference.
Not there
yet. Two Americas. Yeah. But there are parts of America where people are dining indoors, maskless, where large swaths of the population are still unvaccinated.
Yep.
And that is, I think, almost a bigger threat here in the U.S. It's not so much that the vaccinated people aren't able to keep on top of a potential variant. The reason the variants exist is because people aren't vaccinated. Some people aren't vaccinated because they haven't had the opportunity, and we have to correct that. Some people aren't vaccinated because they're eschewing the science and they're saying, I don't want to be vaccinated. And that is a more, I think, insidious problem. And one that doesn't have a very obvious answer, right? The obvious answer to the globe not being vaccinated is do everything we can.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
How do you force a vaccine into the arm of somebody who doesn't want it? That's a way more insidious problem.
Yep. I agree. No, I think it's what's limiting.
Yeah. Trust us. We know about
the U.S. right now. Our vaccine program has maxed itself out. It's now pushing up against vaccine hesitant, vaccine deniers, which is largely political. It's like,
we were so behind. And then overnight, we had one of the best vaccine programs in the world.
Oh my God.
We just picked up the pace so quickly. And now, you're right. We're hitting a wall again.
Mm-hmm. It's tragic because we have the vaccines and there we have people who don't want to take them. And yet there are people clamoring for them around the world who
disgusted.
It is.
It's gluttonous. In a way, like it has that. Yeah, I'm sure that people are not looking very kindly.
Although it kind of reminds me like when our parents would say, eat your vegetables. There are kids starving in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
It's like, could I send the broccoli over to the kids in Ethiopia?
I mean, sure. It's not. Yeah. It's actually interesting, Steve, that you bring that up, because clearly that's an indictment of a systemic problem, not the child sitting at the table. But in this case, it is the person refusing the vaccine.
I know.
Yeah, it's true. It's ironic.
Yeah.
All right, Kara.
Yes.
So we were talking about the WHO. They have some things to say about the ethics of human genome editing.
They do. So this is, I think, a really exciting kind of, I don't even want to say first steps. I think it's more than first steps, but some exciting progress. So a little bit of background. human genome editing has been sort of on the world scene for several years. We talk quite a lot on the show about CRISPR-Cas9 and even CRISPR-Cas, do we call it 10 or X? Some of the like iterations and improvements, but CRISPR-Cas9 still seems to be kind of the name of the game. And we also talked a little bit, actually a lot, about some of the ethical missteps that have been made, specifically with the Chinese researcher slash physician who chose without any sort of permissions or guidance to germline edit some embryos, right? And then kind of announce that to the world stage. And that, I think, did set off a lot of alarm bells, and it really moved some ethical concerns more quickly. It may have directly or somewhat indirectly led to the formation of the Expert Advisory Committee on Developing Global Standards for Governance and Oversight of Human Genome Editing. That is a long name for a committee. That would be the ECDGSGAH.
Sounds like the first part of that.
Yeah, thanks. And the WHO, they formed this committee, I think, in 2018, and then they started to really get to work. And, you know, even as far back as 2015, there was the first international summit on human gene editing. But the WHO specifically said, you know, we need to put something together and we need to develop a framework and we need to publish. So they made this expert advisory committee, I'll just call it the committee from here on out, in 2018. And then they started to get to work. And they not only, I think it's made up of 18 individuals, and they consulted with a ton of people. I think I have a list here of all the different types of inputs that they had. So they made sure that their committee was drawn from each of the WHO regions. So we had individuals on the committee from Africa, the Americas, Southeast Asia, Europe, Eastern Mediterranean, and the Western Pacific. And they spoke to people from the UN, from different academies of science and medicine. They spoke to people from everything from like national all the way down to regional authorities for regulatory boards, health ministries, NGOs, national boards of technology, patient advocacy groups, civil rights organizations, even private companies, national academies, bioethics committees, and indigenous groups. So what they ultimately came up with was 9 areas of recommendations. The first area of recommendations was actually for the leadership of the WHO and the director general. Like, what should they do? Well, they should demonstrate, you know, scientific and moral leadership. They should state, you know, they should make an ethics statement. They should outline the consequences of failing to address these ethical issues, blardy, blardy, blar. And part of that was a reiteration of a statement that the director general actually made back in 2019, quote, "It would be irresponsible at this time for anyone to proceed with clinical applications of human germline genome editing." So there was a very hard and fast line that the director general took from the WHO, a policy, you know, directive, like basically saying, we do not condone this. Like, nobody should be doing human germline genome editing. The next recommendation is about international collaboration for governance and oversight. So, you know, who are the stakeholders here? Who should be having these conversations? How can we facilitate communication? The third point was creating a registry. So they actually developed a registry of human genome editing clinical trials, and they're trying to, let's say, like, lubricate. They're trying to make it as easy as possible for individuals to post to that registry, to use the right keywords within that registry so that anybody can have open access to the information of human trials that are utilizing genome editing. They also have a recommendation based on international research and medical travel, which is basically, if you are not, like, do not go to a country where they don't have oversight mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And try and get any sort of procedure done or do research. Like, make sure, because right now, again, this is jurisdiction by jurisdiction. Different countries, different municipalities have their own laws. The WHO doesn't have jurisdiction to step on anybody's laws. All they can say is these are our recommendations, and it's based on a lot of input from a lot of very important stakeholders. And so, you know, one of the recommendations is don't go try and get medical treatment in a country where there's no oversight and there's no regulation. Just a few more. The next one is illegal, unregistered, unethical, or unsafe research and other activities. So this is something that obviously we care about a lot here at the SGU, basically pseudoscience, right? Places where individuals are touting human genome editing as a treatment when, you know, the research isn't in, whether they're actually doing editing or not, or they're just unethically doing editing like the like this researcher did with the embryos, well, the young children, I should say now, they were born with the kind of AIDS treatment. It was about AIDS, right,
Steve?
Yeah.
It was to prevent the father from transferring it in the sperm. But there are the one of the big criticisms was there are other ways of preventing that that are proven.
Right, they're drugs. They're drugs he could have taken.
Well, if it's IVF, you know, so there are ways of screening out the infected.
That too,
But this and this all reminds me of the stem cell clinics that cropped up, you know, in poorly regulated parts of the world or in places where the government was, in fact, in cahoots, you know, with the clinics. So, you know, so they created an industry of stem cell tourism. You know, I wonder if we're going to see the same thing with genetic therapy tourism, you know?
Yeah, and I think that they, the WHO is brilliant in foreseeing that. Like, this is probably going to happen. And so they established recently a science council, and with the advice from that science council, they are now charging the science division of the WHO to create a multi-sector collaboration where they're going to develop a mechanism for confidential reporting. Because again, they don't have jurisdiction to go put the, you know, to go tamp down. They can obviously make recommendations, don't do this. But what goes one step beyond that? Report possibly illegal, unregistered, unethical, and unsafe human genome editing research and other activities confidentially to this place. Let's put a mechanism in place so that we can at least be aware of this. And I think that's a really important thing that came out of this meeting, perhaps one of the most important things. They also are looking into intellectual property and what's the most ethical way to ensure that intellectual property is protected, but at the same time that patent holders are encouraged to ensure equitable access to these types of interventions. One of the biggest things that I saw over and over in this statement was, this has the potential to save so many lives. It has, you know, human genome editing has the potential to cure so much disease, to prevent so much pestilence and suffering, but it also has the potential to create massive inequity. Mm-hmm. It has the potential to double down on the inequity that already exists and cause an even bigger rift than we already see, where the rich get these types of treatments and the rich are never sick and the poor continue to suffer. And so this is a really important part of the committee. And then there's a section on education, engagement, and empowerment, a section on ethical values and principles for use by the WHO. And then lastly, a review of the recommendations. So they are saying that in no more than 3 years, their science division is going to do an extensive review of all of these recommendations and the progress made to implement them. And they have 18 months to do so. So you can read all of the real specifics there. But what I'm really liking, again, we know that the WHO is a massive bureaucratic machine, but that it's sort of a global effort to say this could be dangerous for all of us. And we all have to work together to come up with basic principles.
Yeah, the two things I think are, for me, the most important. One is regulating germline changes, because that gets into the population.
And right. And they're basically like, no, none. Right now, the statement is still, let's not do it.
That's a high threshold.
Even I agree it's premature for that.
Yeah. And the second is preventing pseudoscientific exploitative clinics from cropping up.
Definitely. Oh.
And I love that it's central. Nice. You know, it's a huge part of this recommendation. That's great.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Kara. All right, Bob, we're going to shift gears here away from medical stuff. You're going to tell us about how is the Kepler telescope finding rogue planets?
Yeah, rogue planets in the news recently got my attention. So what appears to be new rogue planets have been discovered near the center of our galaxy using microlensing techniques on old Kepler Space Telescope data. This was recently published in Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. A study was led by Ian MacDonald of the University of Manchester, UK. So let's quickly revisit what a rogue planet is. Haven't talked about it in a while. It's not, as some believe, a skeptical planet that's a little older but still quite fetching. No, that would be very, very silly. It's simply a planetary mass object untethered to a star. 30 or so rogue planet candidates have been discovered. I looked at it, tried to get the latest list. There's about, I think, 27, probably not including these yet. And they've been discovered. Now, some of them are likely to be what's called sub-brown dwarfs. They form on their own, like all stars, but they just don't have the mass needed to ignite fusion. So they're really not rogue planets. Depends how you define things, but that's what some of them are. The others are likely to be true planets, like as we envision true planets. These true rocky planets, rogue dwarfs, were probably ejected from their solar system by some sort of gravitational interaction with other planets or perhaps other stars that wandered too close. Astronomers believe that that's kind of common in most solar systems, that you've got these lots of these protoplanets orbiting around, and some of them could, you know, like two or three could easily be ejected early in the life of a solar system. So now it's time for a little tangent. That reminds me of a short story, A Pale of Air by Fritz Lieber. Wonderful, wonderful short story. In it, the Earth is pulled away from our sun by a black hole, and it freezes the atmosphere, causing the gases to snow onto the Earth in layers. So hence the Pale of Air title, which is such a fun short story. So anywho, so this latest batch of rogue planets was discovered by looking through Spitzer Telescope data from 2016. So it's about 5 or 6 years old. Now at that time, Spitzer looked at a field of millions of stars, literally millions of stars near the center of the Milky Way every 30 minutes for 2 months. And it was looking for microlensing events. Now that's when a background star is magnified by the gravity of a foreground star. Right? We've talked about this a few times. These were, of course, predicted by Einstein, but, you know, what didn't he predict? He did think, though, that, that we probably would never be able to see them because they would just be way too subtle. But he was wrong. Now, analyzing the Kepler data with new techniques showed 27 microlensing events. Now, many of those were also noticed by Earth observatories at the same time, but 4 of them, however, were different. They were of such brief duration that it's likely that they were caused by rogue planets near Earth's mass. So that's the big takeaway, is that these four microlensing events were so brief, so fast. Cause I mean, some of these lensing events could last for hours or days, actually, which is a little surprising. But some of these were so short that they say, yeah, these are most likely rogue planets because they were so short. And it was quite a technical feat. Just teasing this information out of the data was really, really, really hard. The study lead Ian MacDonald said, "These signals are extremely difficult to find. Our observations pointed an elderly, ailing telescope with blurred vision at one of the most densely crowded parts of the sky, where there are already thousands of bright stars that vary in brightness and thousands of asteroids that skim across our field. From that cacophony, we try to extract tiny characteristic brightenings caused by planets, and we only have one chance to see a signal before it's gone. It's about as easy as looking for the single blink of a firefly in the middle of a motorway using only a handheld phone." Okay? So what's going to happen in the future? Well, remember that they have not confirmed the existence of these rogue planets based on this Kepler data alone. They seem likely to be rogue planets. So they would probably want to confirm this in the near future by using other microlensing observations like NASA's Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, which is launching relatively soon, which is going to be wonderful, and the European Space Agency's Euclid mission. Both of those missions could really help really confirm that, yes, these were indeed rogue planets that we spotted. And like I said, there's only 30 of these suspected rogue planets. But the real interesting thing is that astronomers think that is the tip of the iceberg. It's the tip of the tip of the iceberg, because their calculations show that there could be potentially billions or trillions of them in the Milky Way alone. Can you imagine trillions of these rogue planets, you know, not in orbit around a star? And so hopefully at some point, Nancy Grace specifically, I think, will hopefully give us better estimates so that we could say, for, you know, we could narrow it down from billions or trillions to, you know, maybe oh, it's definitely in the trillions, or maybe, oh yeah, it's lower than we thought, but there's still billions of these rogue planets. Who knows where the true number will be, but either one of those would be pretty amazing. And you can't help but just extrapolate, like, okay, we've got billions or perhaps trillions of these rogue planets just, you know, carousing around the galaxy or maybe all galaxies. Well, what are the chances of them actually having life? And perhaps that's a topic of another discussion, but I'm going to give you some details right now. Anyway, now you might think, you know, these rogue planets, they don't have a host star. You know, what kind of life could possibly be on that? Well, you'd be true if you're thinking about, you know, photosynthetic-based life. But that's not everything. It's not even everything here on Earth. Talking about just the pure energy available that's not based on the sun, this geothermal energy that, you know, from radioisotope decay, that could actually maintain surface warm enough for liquid water. That surprised me. Liquid water on a planet with no sun just because of a radioisotope decay. That's pretty fantastic. And if you are an ejected rogue's planet and you kept your satellite, which they estimate that 5% of Earth-like rogue planets could actually hold on to a moon-sized satellite. That
would be quite the discovery.
It's a hell of a scenario. But if you have that satellite, then what do you have? You have geological tidal heating.
Of course.
Right there. Extra, there's more energy for you.
Your partner does the work, yeah.
Right? And I mean, look at some of the moons of Jupiter. Some of them are basically turning themselves inside out all because of tidal forces. I mean, it's amazingly powerful stuff. Or if a rogue planet still has a magnetosphere and there's also seafloor volcanism, then you could have hydrothermal vents. And with hydrothermal vents, like on the Earth, you have chemosynthetic life. You have life that basically lives off the minerals that are on the planet or in the planet, and you're not living off photosynthetic organisms at all. And they exist.
Extremophiles?
They exist on the Earth right now. We know that chemosynthetic life exists, and it could certainly exist. And I would bet that they exist on at least some rogue planets. So basically, I'm waiting for a really good science fiction story that I'm not aware of any that I want to read one that has planets like this, because what a ripe vein, you know, to draw from, because there's not much science fiction out there that talks about life on a rogue planet like this. I know there's a couple out there, but there's not too many.
Bob, by coincidence, I'm rereading the Foundation series.
Yes, I know.
And
you are.
I think it's in the Foundation and Empire. They actually mention a rogue planet. They use a rogue planet as a base at one point. Yeah.
Wow. And that was written was that in the 80s?
50s, right?
52, oh, this is Foundation and Empire? Yeah. Okay, yeah. So it's the second one. What? That's something, because I don't think that was on anyone's radar back then, or at least was on Asimov's.
Asimov also mentions that there are banned planets where you have a
lots of groups playing
equator.
Music and stuff. Oh, okay.
No, like if you have a band of livable space around the equator with one side, you know, tidally locked.
Right.
Yeah. So he was plugged
in. That's pretty good, too. I didn't think anyone was even thinking about that back then either. Sweet.
That's kind of why I'm rereading them. I want to say, all right, I haven't read them in 35-plus years.
Oh, my God,
Anyway, this is a longer conversation. Very interesting kind of time capsule of futurism and science fiction back in 1950.
Cool.
All right, Evan.
Yes.
Tell us about recent milestones in space tourism.
Heck yes. I think everyone's aware of this one. You know, that we've been producing the SGU since May of 2005. So we are in our 17th year.
Jeez.
Isn't that amazing? It was 17 years ago that Richard Branson, a person that's been pretty well known to my generation, certainly. But 17 years ago, Branson announced the signing of a deal under which a new space tourism company called Virgin Galactic would license technology to take paying passengers into suborbital outer space 17 years ago. 2004, you know, that's a lofty goal, weak pun intended. And there were more than a few skeptical people out there who felt that such a venture, this mission was just going to be too much for really a private company to succeed. Well, here we are 17 years later, and it became a reality on July 11th, 2021. That's just a few days ago when Virgin Galactic VSS Unity launched from its carrier aircraft called VMS Eve, 43,000 feet above the skies of New Mexico. Unity disconnected from Eve, and Unity fired its thrusters, accelerating more than three times the speed of sound to climb to the edge of space. On the flight was, of course, Sir Richard himself, accompanied by Dave McKay, Colin Bennett, Beth Moses. Sarisha Bandla and pilot Michael Masucci. I absolutely love the design of the space launch. We know where the space plane drops out from underneath the carrier vehicle. It's to me, it's like a dance, you know, where you've got partners kind of each doing their part, a ballet or so. Maybe subconsciously, it reminds me of a birthing. You know, I'll let Kara Cycle analyze me on that later.
But I don't even want to go there.
Well, I mean, you know,
you keep that birthing imagery to yourself, my friend.
Now,
that would be an interesting counterpoint to Jeff Bezos's imagery of his rocket.
Yes, which is more the traditional blast off. Like, yeah,
I mean, it's unnecessarily penis-like in shape.
But Eve, the carrier vehicle, was named for Richard's mother. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's some layer, maybe perhaps of truth to that. And Steve, like you said, it's very different than seeing the traditional form of rocketry, like, you know, Saturn rockets or Orion rockets. It's just neat to see that there's more than one way to get into space. That's what I love about this. Now, the spacecraft reached an altitude of 86.1 kilometers, that's 53.5 miles, roughly 282,000 feet. And it was a suborbital flight, not capable of getting into orbit around the Earth, as you know. The maximum altitude of that ship can go to about 90, so it's not really capable of achieving any orbital flight. It's not what it's designed for. So,
you know, also, the Kármán line, which is where the space begins, is 100 kilometers.
The Conga line? What was that?
No, the Kármán line. Kármán line. K-A-R-M-A-N.
Yeah. That technically, he didn't get into, quote unquote, space. That's why they're saying the edge of space, because he didn't get all the way there. Although NASA will give you your astronaut wings if you get above 50 miles, and they did make that.
Yeah, do you know there's some a little bit of controversy with the Kármán or the von Kármán line, as some call it, because what is it? Is it 80 kilometers, that 50 mile barrier, or are we talking about 100 kilometers, which is what the I believe it's called the FAI basically says that it is, and like Steve, you're referring to it as the von Kármán line. But apparently the controversy is that supposedly they took von Kármán's, and he was Theodor von Kármán, a Hungarian-American engineer and physicist who was active in aeronautics and astronautics in 1957. He was the first person to attempt to derive an altitude limit of where, you know, basically space is. He calculated it apparently at 84 kilometers, not the 100 kilometers, but still he gets credited with his name as the von Kármán line or the Kármán line as being 100 kilometers. So it's a sort of misattribution that the international agency adopted for their own purposes to say, okay, the line is 100 kilometers, we're going to call it the von Kármán line, even though he really only measured it to 84 kilometers. But that's kind of a sidetrack, but I thought it was interesting. It was a little
But there is a physical reason for it. It's not just the upper limit of the mesosphere. So I think his estimates were off, but I think they're still using the theoretical definition.
Right.
But there's different ways you could define it.
It's all subjective.
That sounded like a Wikipedia rabbit hole, was it?
Oh, it was. Absolutely.
Oh, I love those.
Yep. And then YouTube videos about it. And we could go on for hours just about that, but we're not going to. There's been – so this is obviously historic for a lot of reasons, you know, private company being able to do this. And, you know, we have Jeff Bezos's launch coming up just next week. In which he's going to hit the 100-kilometer height. He's in the Blue Origin's New Shepard spacecraft. He and his team will go up. But there's been a lot of discussions over the years, and certainly now it's being brought back into light again, about what's the utility here, practicality, broader significance of the private space tourism ventures and industry. Is it worth it? Should society be encouraging private space travel? And what kind of maybe greater good can come from something that's, well, they some people call it just an amusement ride for the ultra rich people on the planet who can only ever afford this. So I know we've talked about it a little bit before.
You guys know that I feel slightly differently than you do about this.
Well, I think there's a good case to be made for the fact that, you know, sure, this is now going to be the realm of millionaires and billionaires. So like they're, for the Virgin Galactic, you can get a ticket on that for $250,000. And one person paid $28 million to fly with Bezos and on his on the Blue Origin. And three people have paid $55 million to Axiom to go up on the SpaceX's Dragon capsule. So yeah, right. So there's rich people paying a ton of money or planning on it. But that will bootstrap a commercial spaceflight industry, which will trickle down in lots of ways. So fine, sure. let the rich people be early adopters and pay for technology that will then at some point have an impact on the masses. The cars were a toy for rich people when they first came out. Mm-hmm. Planes were toys for rich people when they first were developed. This is a typical pattern that we follow. Let them pay the big bucks. Yeah. All right, guys. How much do you know about hydroponics? Hydroponic farming.
Ooh, I know
hydroponics.
About, hydro I know about hydroponic weeds.
Water and ponics is.
This is one of those things.
Uses water.
Yeah, this is one of those things I've been hearing about my entire life, right? Hydroponics, it's like supposed to be this high-tech farming of the future, but it's a ride at Disney World. I mean, right at Epcot Center, rather. they show off the futuristic hydroponic farming. Cool. I remember there was like this movie. What was it about? Like Saturn V? Not Saturn V.
It was a
movie about a base on Io where they were doing hydroponics. It was with Kurt Douglas and Farrah Fawcett.
Saturn 3.
Okay, Saturn 3. Anyway, that was all about hydroponics.
Killer robot.
That was if they were doing hydroponic farming on one of the moons of Jupiter. So, what is the state of hydroponics, and or do you think we're going to be seeing more of it?
I think they're using dehydrated water now.
Yeah, that was a big innovation. So, the basics of hydroponics is that it's farming without soil. You infuse the water itself with the mineral nutrients, and the roots of most plants are fully capable of absorbing those nutrients through the water. They don't need to be surrounded by soil. This was made possible by a botanist, Julius von Sachs, in 1860 when he published a study showing specifically what nutrient mixture needed to be added to water in order to allow plants to grow. I basically figured out what all the nutrients a plant would need to grow. So since then, hydroponics became possible. So,
and less dirty plant growing.
So for the question then is, sorry, so what are the advantages and disadvantages of hydroponics? How far has it come? What is the state of the technology? So there's a number, came across a number of different articles, different studies, comparing hydroponic farming to traditional soil-based farming. And the potential benefits are really pretty enormous.
Enormous.
Depending on exactly how you do it. So let's go over all of the potential advantages, and then we'll discuss some of the disadvantages. So one advantage is that this can all be done indoors, right? Mm-hmm. And because you don't need soil, it's a lot easier to do vertical farming. So you could theoretically have a 100-story high rise that's all farmland, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you can also seal it then, which means you don't have any leakage of like evaporation to the elements.
So
it's like a closed system.
Yeah. So the closed system. So maybe the single biggest advantage, if not one of them, is decreased water usage. I've read a number of different estimates, usually clustering around the 5-10% of traditional farming in terms of water use.
Wow.
But some eat much less than that. So it's possible because you could recycle all the water and it's not evaporating, as Kara said. It could be a closed system. So the other big advantage, of course, is land use. So land and water, two huge limited resources. And hydroponics can have use significantly less, so 5% or less of the water of soil farming, and how much more could you produce per acre of vertical hydroponic farming versus traditional farming? Again, it depends on how vertical you go, et cetera. But it could be in the hundreds of times. I've read estimates of a specific design 360 times the production of a similar area soil-based farming. Yeah,
it's also portable. Like I visited, they were what do you call them? Shipping container farm, where they could put it on wheels and basically take it to a local community where the imports. Like usually, what you have to do is pick the produce and then ship the produce after it's picked. So it's like not nearly as fresh. It doesn't have the longest shelf life. But if you can move the whole farm to the community and sell it, you know, right when it's harvested, it has a much longer shelf life.
Or Kara, you could just have a vertical high-rise hydroponic farm in the middle of a city.
Yeah, totally. Right? So you could have your apartment complex and your whatever.
Yeah, so you could have significant urban farming. And as Kara, as you said, you don't have to ship it because it's basically you're growing it right where the demand is. And that means several things. So first of all, you save all of the expense of shipping it.
Yeah.
But also, you don't have to optimize the cultivar to being able to be shipped.
Right.
Rather, you can optimize it for nutrition and for taste, you know, for other characteristics. And because it never will be shipped, it'll be you harvested right where you're selling it.
Fresh. Nice.
So plants that are hydroponically grown don't have to grow roots that are as large. They can have much smaller roots, means they can invest more of their energy into the part that you eat.
Yeah, right.
And they could be a lot closer together. And a couple other advantages to being indoors. One is no pests, right?
Yeah.
So no pesticides, no herbicides, right? There's no weeds. So no pesticides of any kind would be necessary, you know.
You can control for that entirely?
Well, you can control the environment, right? So again, it's because there's no soil, there's no seeds are going to blow in. And, you know, you can also control the environment so that I'm sure that some pests may get in, but it's much less, you know, pests are going to get access to your crops.
Sure. Right.
Plus, you can also control the humidity, you control the temperature, you can control the amount of light, you can control the frequency of light. And
as long as the power doesn't go out, you're okay.
Exactly. That's now you're getting to the downside is the power. So that can lead to optimized growing. Hydroponic plants grow much faster than soil-based plants because you can scientifically, you know, micromanage all of these environmental details. And some of the hydroponically grown cultivars have better nutrition and better taste, you know, than their soil-grown counterparts. So some people think for some reason that they would be worse in those regards, but in fact, if anything, they're better. All right.
Wow, so that's pretty amazing advantages. I mean, what's the downside? That it's all poisonous? What the hell?
No, so no, it's like the advantages are immense.
And no, what could I can't think of a downside that would negate all that awesomeness.
Well, there's one downside that could completely negate it, and that is it's expensive, right? So if it's not economically viable, who cares?
Yeah, right.
Hydroponically grown crops are more expensive than their soil grown counterparts in general, but they don't necessarily have to be. And there are some which are successfully. I just ate a hydroponically grown strawberry today. Hydroponically grown leafy greens is very common. You can buy hydroponically grown lettuce. I've seen in the store for years. So they're you know not any more expensive than organically grown food. You know, so they're in that realm that people are willing to pay for. And again, with greater efficiency and scale, et cetera, the cost can come down. The big resource difference is that they're 10 to 11 times the energy use of a soil-based farming because, of course, you know, you're basically substituting energy for soil, sunlight, and water, right? You're using 5% of the water, you know, using, you know, 1% or a fraction of a percent of the land. In order to get vertical, you need to use grow lights, right? So you need to have electricity. Most of the electricity is actually
you need
goes
a structure.
For
you need to build a structure.
Well, yeah, there's more infrastructure as well. Most of the energy goes to environmental control, then lighting, and then like water pump systems are not that much at all. So it's just the environmental control that is energy intensive, but not a deal killer. And if you think about it, you know, as we go into the future, land is getting more precious, more scarce.
Yeah. Yep, got to find different ways.
And fresh water is getting more scarce. 70% of global fresh water is used for agriculture. 70%. And that's a precious resource. And energy, not so much. I mean, yes, you know, it's getting cheaper. Let's just say that. It's obviously we don't want to just, you know, have a dramatic increase in how much energy we need to use. But if anything, energy is getting cheaper in the future as, you know, solar panels and other things get much more efficient and much cheaper. In other words, going forward, it's probably going to be more and more resource and cost effective to grow hydroponically because of the land and water savings, and the energy and the increased energy cost is going to be less and less of a burden. So you might think then, therefore, that hydroponic farming should be dramatically increasing, and it is, and it is. Mm-hmm. So
what percentage is it?
It's still a very small percentage of overall agriculture, but the market, the worldwide market of hydroponic farming is like over 9 billion and projected to triple in the next 10 years. So it's significantly increasing, and it may increase much more dramatically as the technology improves and as I think people start to realize, you know, how efficient this could be. So think about, like, if you're a city in the Middle East where there isn't a lot of good, you know, arable land or, you know, water, but you got a lot of, you know, a lot of money, a lot of energy, a lot of
perfect. Perfect for hydroponics.
You could exactly build massive vertical hydroponic farms, and which use very little water and no soil. It kind of makes perfect sense. So I don't think this is a panacea. Like no one technology ever is, and I don't think it's going to replace soil-based farming. But it could be one of the ways that we keep up with the growing population. Again, by 2050, we're probably going to be hitting 10 billion people on the planet. So we got to be increasing our food production by 20-30%. And there really isn't any more farmland to move into. So we've got to produce more calories per acre of land. And this is one way to do it. So I think for that, maybe for that reason alone, you know, that we're going to need, among other solutions, we're going to need
like
GMOs, and also you could marry the two. You could GMO plants to optimize them for hydroponic farming, you know.
For sure, yeah.
Make it so that they need less nutrients, less sunlight, less whatever is expensive.
Whatever features, you know, make plants, you know, able to grow hydroponically better. I mean, you can grow theoretically any plant hydroponically, but yes, some better than others.
Sure.
But that you know, hundreds of times the food production per area of land advantage is hard to argue with. And land is the one thing that we're pretty much out of. Like there is no more arable land that doesn't require us to, you know, burn down forest or displace villagers or build it and grow it
on the ocean.
Yeah. And also, you know, getting back to space exploration, how do you think we're going to be growing food on the moon, right? Mars? It's going to be vertical hydroponic. Yeah.
Totally. Oh, yeah. For sure.
Yeah. They've already done it aboard the ISS. You know, they made that something like that red leaf lettuce or something, just as a proof of concept. They don't grow anywhere near enough food to feed the astronauts up there. But it wouldn't take long. It wouldn't take much. I mean, the Soviets actually did a test where they had like their habitat, like their simulated habitat, where they tried to actually grow all the food the people there would need to eat. Mm-hmm. And it only took like an acre and a half of land
That's
per person
nothing.
To do that. Yeah, it wasn't much. And if you're growing all the food you need to eat, you're actually making more oxygen than you need to breathe.
There
Isn't
you go.
Interesting?
Another plus.
Yeah. You actually make more oxygen than you need, so then you can bank the rest for fuel.
Turn it into fuel. Yep.
Yeah. I thought it was curious because like this thing I've been hearing about for 40 years,
right?
It maybe coming into its own. I mean, it's always been there, like, you know, in the background, just as a small thing. But it might, you know, in the next 20 years, it may become huge. You know, part of our strategy of feeding the world.
I wonder if these foods will be labeled as such. You have to label them hydroponic.
Well, they are. They are labeled as hydroponic, but it's more of a, I think, people
marketing.
See, it as a positive marketing thing. Speaking of which, you might think that organic farmers would be down with the whole hydroponic thing.
I would think so.
But they're not.
I wonder why. Because they have a corner of the market right now.
Yeah, because it's a brand thing. So, the hill that they're fighting on is whether or not you can label a hydroponically grown produce
as organic.
Organic. They're arguing. Yes. They're arguing no, and they're saying yeah, but it doesn't use any pesticides and. You know, whatever it could meet all of the requirements.
Yes,
for being organic.
Do a goalpost to make it. Mm-hmm.
Yes, so this is what they say. They say organic farming is all about the soil. It's about how could you have organic farming without soil? Because that's the focus of the whole philosophy of organic farming, which to me is just more evidence that they don't care about the actual product.
Right.
It is all about the brand,
which
is all about the, it's all about the method of farming. It's not about the end result. And
because
it's all philosophy
based.
Because
here's the clean thing. You can clean water and then you can add to it what it needs. You cannot clean soil by definition. Soil is going to absorb everything that's around it.
They say that there's something magical that the soil does that we don't understand. You can't get that hydroponically.
Sort of a,
a bunch of assholes.
Keep your magic soil. Yeah, it is.
The magic
this
of
is
the
actually,
earth.
All right. So I'm going to like gently segue into a question. This is a your question and email segment. This one comes from Jeff Marsh from Pittsburgh, who writes, any thoughts on biodynamic wine, which combines organic agriculture and astrology? It has to be nonsense, but I would be interested in hearing your take on this subject. Can't remember how much you've spoken about biodynamic farming in the past, but it is very relevant to what we were just talking about with organic farming. Biodynamic farming is basically the astrology of agriculture. But the thing that's interesting, so Jeff is writing as if it's an offshoot of organic farming, but it's actually the other way around. Organic farming is an offshoot of biodynamic farming.
Ooh, interesting.
If you look at it historically, which is just like this is not a poisoning the well, but I mean, it is, I think, always interesting to know when something has such clear pseudoscientific roots. Biodynamic farming was developed by a man by the name of Rudolf Steiner, who was born in 1861. And he was a total crank. He believed in a lot of nonsense. He was an anti-vaxxer. He basically was a guru, right? He rejected the science of his day and was trying to substitute his own guru philosophy belief systems. Mm-hmm. And so one of the many nonsensical things that he developed was biodynamic farming, which is one part mysticism, one part quackery. It involves things like homeopathy, right? They use like homeopathic remedies on the soil. It does use astrology, like you have to plant certain types of crops under a full moon or under different times of the, according to the astrological calendar. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of voodoo in there, like where you have to like fill a cow's horn with manure and bury it on the north side of your field for a season. Like all kinds of magical witchcraft kind of stuff, right? That's biodynamic farming. It's complete nonsense. But then he threw in there some things which turned into the kernel of organic farming.
Oh my gosh.
No chemical fertilizer, and we're going to replenish the living soil, and we're going to do it sustainably or whatever. So the organic farming sort of took that piece of it and to make into their own brand. Yeah. So, but it kind of started out as sort of this biodynamic farming, which still exists, on the fringe today. And it just I think it's just now a purely marketing thing. I doubt most people know what biodynamic means. It just sounds good. Oh, I got biodynamic wine, it's now just like a pure marketing thing, like homeopathy or organic, where people don't really know what it is or what the science says about it, but it just has this health halo, this natural kind of halo around it. And that's how it's used. But yeah, it's like biodynamic farming is complete nonsense. It is astrology.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Yikes.
All right, guys, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Three news items this week, no theme. You guys ready?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right, here we go. Item number one. A precinct-level study in New York City finds that the presence of adult entertainment establishments decreased sex crimes by 13% with no effect on other types of crimes. Item number two, an extensive study of historical population levels in Rapa Nui, Easter Island, finds that population levels were in steady decline prior to the arrival of Europeans in 1722. And item number three, a prospective study of cognitively healthy people with an average age of 80 found that those with low levels of mental activity developed dementia on average by age 89, while those with a high level of mental activity developed dementia on average by age 94, a delay of 5 years. And I'll just say by mental activity, I mean things like doing puzzles and reading and things like that. All right, Kara, you go first this week.
Okay, so New York City, presence of adult entertainment establishes decreases sex crimes by 13%. That's a lot. With no effect on other types of crimes. Kind of doesn't make sense at first blush, but also maybe if they're going there, like if somebody who was already like started to feel a compulsion to commit sexual violence goes to a strip club and gets it out of their system. Although you can't go do like safe violence in a strip club. So I don't know. This one kind of sits funny for me. It's different than the studies about computer generated child porn or something like that. Where could that be an outlet for somebody who already has that predilection? Historical population levels of Rapa Nui were in steady decline prior to the arrival of Europeans in 1722. Literally, the only thing I know about Easter Island is that white people stole those statues and put them in their museums and stuff. That's like the only thing I know. So I know that there was a colonial influence. I know that it was not great, but I have no idea. Why would they be in decline? Maybe there's food was drying up or something and they intentionally left. When you say population levels were in steady decline, you're not specifying because of, emigration or because of...
I'm not saying why at all, just that
right,
they were.
Right, yeah. Just that there were fewer people. The number of people was going down. Mm-hmm. They could have been leaving. They could have been dying. Okay, and a prospective study of cognitively healthy people, average age of 80. Those with low levels of mental activity developed dementia on average by age 89. Those with high level developed dementia on average by 94. Okay, so... A 5-year delay. Okay. I do know that in rehab settings, and I work in a neuropsych rehab setting also, that one of the recommendations is to do stuff mentally when somebody is starting to show early signs. So do crossword puzzles, read books, like stay mentally active. And I hope that this recommendation isn't based on no evidence and it's just like, sounds good, let's recommend it. So I'm going to say hopefully that one is science. The prospective study reinforced what we think, which is that if you remain nimble mentally, that it can have a protective effect against dementia, especially because we're not specifically looking at vascular or Alzheimer's, like something where there's a pathology that's kind of all types of dementia thrown in. So the two that are bothering me are Rapa Nui and New York City. I could see both being true, although the mechanism of the presence of adult entertainment establishments decreasing sex crimes by 13%. So you're saying in the immediate vicinity of the adult entertainment establishment, like within that jurisdiction or something, within that precinct?
Yeah, within that precinct, that's correct.
Okay, okay. Yeah, those levels could already be very high depending on where they are. Gosh, this is hard. Versus Rapa Nui, they were already in steady decline. It's probably going to be the opposite of what my gut tells me, but I'm just going to go with my gut and say that no, the adult entertainment establishments did not decrease sex crimes. No, I'm going to say it's the opposite. Okay, they did decrease sex crimes because I think you're trying to get us. And Rapa Nui was not. Wait, what? I'm double negativing myself again. One of these is fiction.
Yes. Which one is the fiction?
The fiction is true. That they were instead. The fiction is the sex crimes one. They did not decrease sex crimes by 13%.
Okay. Bob.
God. Sorry, yeah. Bob. I'm of no help.
Yeah, this one's tough.
That's hard.
Yeah, at first blush of the eight, you know, the dementia one, I was thinking that, you know, by the time you're 80, you're going to be, you know, I think your path to dementia is probably set, and there's not much you can do about it. But chances are, though, if you're 80 and with low mental activity, you've probably been that way for a while, and vice versa. So I guess I'll go with that one. I was really wanted to say that one was fiction because it just seemed too obvious. And Easter Island, I have no idea. I mean, the implication seems to me like, oh, look, it wasn't the Europeans. They were on a downward spiral before they arrived. So I see where that was going. But I'm going to agree with Karen and say that the Six Crimes one is fiction.
And Evan.
Oh, boy. Carrie, you did help because the one about the cognitive and healthy people in the age 80 versus 89 and 94, I think your analysis did help me there, to determine that one was science. So yeah, it comes down to the other two. It's basically flipping a coin at this point. Do I go with everyone or do I break away? Okay. So here's the thing, the Easter Island one. So I think there's pretty well established a lot of patterns in which, you know, the arrival of Europeans to places helped with the decline of, you know, the indigenous populations of those places. Why would this be an exception to that? That's kind of like the only thing I can't really square up. Whereas the one with New York City and the sex crimes, 13%, like you said, it could have been very high to begin with. And, you know, 13% drop maybe almost seems like a lot, but maybe it really isn't a lot. No effect on other types of sex crimes. That would be the trick there. I'll say it's the Easter Island one. Sorry, guys. I'll go different on this one.
No, it's better. Now he won't sweep us, maybe.
Well, unless it's...
unless it's the last one.
Let's take the dementia one. Shorter, then we'll start with three, since you guys all agree with
this. He sounds really excited.
Study of cognitively healthy people with an average age of 80.
This is awful.
Found that those with low levels of mental activity develop dementia on average by age 89. While those with a high level of mental activity develop dementia by average age 94, a delay of 5 years.
I'm not listening.
That one is science, and that one is science.
Okay.
All
right. So I did not sweep you this week. So yeah. So and Bob, you hit upon thing like the, you know, the 80, like starting at 80 is interesting. And because and Carrie, you're right, there's this already this pre-existing belief based upon evidence that mental activity and physical activity, by the way, is protective against dementia and cognitive decline. But the question was, would the same effect be true in people who are already very old? Because you would think, as Bob said, maybe by then they've already, you know, locked in, you know, their dementia, you know, probability. And so they found it actually a very robust effect, you know. So these people were not demented at 80, and the whether or not they were mentally active was highly predictive of how long before they developed signs of dementia.
So how long were they mentally active?
Right. The active group was several times per week. The inactive group was like several times per year or less.
No, I meant did they start at 80 or have they been doing it since they were 25?
Well, that's why a prospective study, like it can't tell you that, but
But they, you're right. They started at 80 and then followed them forward, but they did gather data and they said actually that there was not much of an effect for mental activity at younger ages. Hmm. And that, in fact, it may be most important to be mentally active as an older adult.
I got some
in your
time then.
70s,
cool.
80s. Yeah. So you could coast, and then when you hit 80, then you got to take up crossword puzzles and...
Interesting.
Know, Sudoku. Sudoku will save you from dementia. But that's huge when you think about that, that given people's life expectancy, you know, that five-year delay could make the difference between, you know, dying of your dementia versus just being at the very, very end of your life anyway. That's a critical 5 years there. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you do. You see it a lot. I mean, we've all known elderly people who were very sharp, like very sharp even into their 90s, even into their whatever. And I mean, at least the ones that I know, it's obviously not a clearly predictive pattern, but they were active. They were doing stuff. They were communicating with other people. They had social circles. They weren't just passively watching TV all day and sort of, you know, like they were mentally active.
And I do think the social aspect is an important part of that mental activity as well. Yeah, it's not just doing things by yourself. Okay, let's go back to number two. An extensive study of historical population levels of Rapa Nui, Easter Island, finds that population levels were in steady decline prior to the arrival of Europeans in 1722. Evan, you alone think this one is the fiction. Mm-hmm. Bob and Kara, you think this one is science. And this one is the fiction. Good job.
Holy crap.
I flipped the coin.
Yeah, me too. I honestly flipped a coin.
It's clear that you guys are torn between the first one and two. So the study actually showed that the population levels were stable and, if anything, increasing right up to the point where the Europeans arrived. Mm-hmm. And this is contrary to prior beliefs. I thought you guys might have known something mm-hmm. about Rapa Nui, that the idea is that the population had all but vanished. And like the European arrival was the coup de grace, but it was like there was one story was that they cut down all the trees to do so that they could convert the land into agriculture, and they needed to use the wood for their Easter Island head manufacturing process, you know, their industry.
Oh my gosh.
And but they were using the palm trees as an important food source, and they didn't realize until it was too late that they had destroyed their own food source. But that turns out it's probably a myth.
Mm-hmm. It also sounds just like so like ugh.
It's a story. I know.
It's so gross. It's just like white people trying to rewrite history so they're not the bad guys again.
But in fact, they were cutting down trees to convert the land to agricultural land to actually help them grow more food and increase, you know, the population that the island could support, and the population was increasing as a result of their increased agriculture, which kind of makes sense. But so there's also other theories, like there was just the island was undergoing a drought, you know, because you're on an island. If you have a climate change, you know, if you have a drought, you're pretty much done, right?
So, yeah, that's kind of what I assume. Maybe something was happening with it, made it so they needed to leave.
And Evan, there were plenty of historical cases of civilizations that died off without the help of Europeans. You know,
I get that.
Because there's the famine and changing climate and whatnot, you know, like some of the Aztec, you know, civilizations, for example.
So but do we know what the mechanism was for the Europeans here? Was it displacement? Was it disease? Was it?
I would guess. My guess was disease is my thought.
It's always like it's disease and rats is usually the two big things.
Yeah, disease, rats, or active genocide.
We come in peace and with smallpox. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
All of this means that a precinct level study in New York City finds that the presence of adult entertainment establishments decreased sex crimes by 13% with no effect on other types of crime is science. This is a very thorough study. There's a lot of data they had here because it was one of those opportunistic studies. They had a really precinct level detailed set of data because of stop and frisk laws. For whatever reason, not sure exactly why that is, but they had this huge data set of precinct level, you know, crime statistics, and they were able to correlate that with the zoning laws about sex adult entertainment establishments like mm-hmm. you know strip clubs. And pornography, you know, sellers, etc. And you know, because one of the theories was that the vice industry tended to attract unsavory characters and would lure in crime, would increase mm-hmm. crime, you know, and that if we wanted to reduce crime in neighborhoods, one of the things you could do is just get rid of all of the adult entertainment, all the vice industries, right? So like that's what they did with Times Square, et cetera.
Yeah. But really they found just pushes it somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. But in any case, what they found was it actually, in terms of at least the adult entertainment specifically, it reduced sex crime by 13%. The reason why they compared it to other types of crime was to say, well, is this because of any change in policing behavior or anything else?
Right.
And because other crimes were unaffected, it seemed to be specific to sex crimes, which does suggest that there is some kind of diversionary effect going on here, that they have another outlet, as it were, because it's not just a generic crime effect or policing effect. It was specific to sex crime. So that was kind of the other types of crime was like the control in this study.
That's good to hear. I mean, like I was kind of hoping it would be the case, but I didn't see quite I saw obviously the potential for diversion, but I wasn't sure I quite understood the mechanism, because you don't go to a strip club to like to fantasize about rape?
No, but so what they think is that they were just doing that instead of committing crimes. Like, it was just another, they were spending their time in strip clubs rather than committing crimes, you know. So
and so they were having like a more like sex positive experience, actually.
Or even whether that, or it's just that, you know, again, time is a zero sum game. And if you're spending 13% of your time doing this, you're not doing whatever, you're not doing it, committing crimes, I guess.
In a way, it's sort of like a safe use area, right? Yeah. Like, if I'm going to use anyway, or if I'm starting to have a compulsion anyway, let me do it in a place where it's sanctioned and where I know it's going to be safe. So even though obviously they're not going to the strip club to rape a woman, there might be a compulsion there. Let's go to a safer outlet for that. Yeah. And it works, which is great.
Yeah.
That's so good to hear. Like, that's I hope that this evidence is actually utilized, utilized for policy, because I think it's very hard for people to accept. Like, people love to moralize this kind of stuff, and it's really hard for them to accept that we can reduce crime and we can prevent atrocities by having alternatives that are safe and that are victimless available. Mm.
Right, right. And that's kind of what number one and number two had in common, was that the results was the opposite of what the researchers were expecting, you know, in both of those cases. Because there was just kind of this idea that it would lure in crime, and the previous theories was that the population was decreasing. So both of those studies were interesting in that way. And of course, I always like those for science or fiction.
Yeah.
Because they're counterintuitive.
Very.
All right, good job, Evan.
Hey, whatever. Thanks.
Go, Evan.
Yay.
All right, Ev, give us a quote.
Because of technologies from space exploration, we can begin to understand our world's origins, and our lives are improving. These are the reasons why dedicating a life to the sciences and space exploration is so meaningful and rewarding. Emily Calandrelli.
Oh, Ev.
Yay, Emily.
You see, Kara? Evan, did you pick that just as a comeback to Kara?
So, trust me, if we had Em on the show right now, she would be like really going hard on equity and talking heavily about a lot of the things that I talked about, because I think both of those things can be true at the same time.
I totally agree.
Emily is definitely heavily in my camp when it comes to like feminism and anti-racist action and things of that nature, and she's an aeronautical engineer turned science communicator, and she's very good at what she does, and she is inspiring a generation of children to be excited about STEM, which is goodness, awesome. So important. Yeah,
absolutely. Her kids show is wonderful.
Yeah, it's great, but they canceled it.
Yeah, they didn't
They
didn't renew it. Why?
There's a big petition right now to you know, push Netflix to get it back on the air.
Maybe they will. They you know, things like that have happened before.
Yeah, she's had like 75,000 signatures or something. Hopefully she's getting more.
All right, guys. So let's see. We are still doing the Friday live streaming thing for those of you who want to join us. Join us for those Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern. I also just wanted to point out that our first extravaganza, it's our live stage show since the pandemic. Our last one was in January of 2020. Our first one will be in Atlanta.
Yes.
We're going to Atlanta, and you don't have to be attending Dragon Con or anything. If just anyone within, you know, the greater Atlanta area could come see our extravaganza. It's a completely independent event. So go to the SGU website, go to the events page. Everything will be there. The Atlanta extravaganza is on September 5th, Sunday, September 5th, at 6 p.m. Yeah, it's going to be fun. So we're going to have a whole bunch of new bits to share with you guys. That show's a lot of fun. All right, so I'm looking forward to seeing everybody there. And
yes, can't wait.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.